Dr. Damasani Tano Dan, you're the host of the Insurgent Radio Network, broadcasting live from the bunker in north central Indiana, right next to Terawatani Tavern, where the elite meet to eat, the mostly drink. Also nearby is Terawatani's Weapons of Mass Destruction Used Equipment Yard, where you can purchase a freshly refurbished weapon of mass destruction for pennies on the dollar, if the price is right. You can reach Tom at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Address your letters and mail to Tom Metzger, Insurgent, the plain old box holder. Good old Tommy will get it.
You better believe it, old Tommy will get it right here in the bunker right here in north central Indiana. 46581 is our P.O. box, and our website is resist.com. Go up there and get a great education. I used to say Harvard, but Harvard gives you a bad education. Most of the money problems this country is in right now came right out of Harvard. Yes, it did. Well, it's the 28th of December 2015, and we're on the countdown now for 2016, and you can start all over and just make as many mistakes as you did in 2015. See if I care. No, don't do that. Don't listen to him. That's his alter ego. Don't listen to him. Well, boys and girls, we got the ice back here today. Yeah, everything's coated with ice. And we had rain, we got ice, we had a little snow, too. So it's a miserable day in northern Indiana. At least we don't have any tornadoes so far. Well, it can't be as bad as the pessimist guide to history, so we'll go back there for a while this morning. 1754, earthquake demolishes Cairo, Egypt. Thousands of people were buried in the ruins of Cairo, Egypt, following a deadly earthquake in September. About 40,000 people were killed and half the houses in the city were demolished. There you go. 1755, Lisbon earthquake. A massive earthquake struck the bustling port city of Lisbon, Portugal, on November the 1st. With such force that its shocks were felt across Europe and North Africa. The quake and subsequent seismic waves and fires killed between 50,000 and 100,000 people and left Lisbon in ruins. The first shock hit about 9:30 in the morning on All Saints' Day. Within 2 minutes, thousands of buildings collapsed. A 15-foot-wide fissure opened in the middle of the city, and thousands of people were crushed to death. The great cathedrals of Lisbon collapsed into hundreds of worshipers gathered for All Saints' Day prayer. Well, God must hate those churches. Lisbon, a city of 275,000 people, was transformed into a scene of horror. Survivors reported seeing buildings swaying like calm in the wind. The grinding of stone against stone as buildings collapsed created, as one survivor put it, the most dreadful crunching, crumbling noise ears could ever hear. Clouds of dust kicked up by fallen debris darkened the city. The streets were filled with people caught by flying debris, either crushed to death beneath massive stones or screaming for a priest to hear their last confession. Repercussions of the quake were felt far from Lisbon. 50-foot waves slammed into Cornwall, England, and reached the Gulf of Finland. Ironically, Mount Vesuvius in Italy suddenly stopped erupting. The quake even shook the West Indies. Some 10,000 people were killed in Fez and Mequinez, Morocco. In Lisbon, those who survived the first three shocks between the 9:30 and 10 o'clock thronged the streets. Of the thousands who took refuge in the city's marble docks, hundreds were washed away by a 50-foot tsunami wave of seawater. By 10:30, The fire joined the destructive forces of the earth and water as massive flames erupted in the city of Lisbon, probably kindled by debris falling into kitchen fires. The flames spread wildly. Every element seemed to conspire to our destruction, one survivor said. The buildings still standing were quickly burned. Lisbon's culture went up in flames, too, as the open houses, convents, and palaces succumbed. The flames consumed 200 paintings by such masters as Titian, Rubens, and Correggio, along with 18,000 priceless rare books and numerous maps used by Portuguese explorers over the centuries. Soon chaos reigned in the city. Convicts fled, freed by the collapse of the prisons, roamed the streets, looting and committing other crimes. Officials responded by setting up gallows in a ring around the city to hang looters. Priests, in their wisdom, wandered the streets looking for heretics to burn, believing the disaster represented God's punishment of Lisbon for its sins. There you go. By the time the last fires burned out, some 17,000 of the 20,000 buildings in Lisbon had been destroyed. Asked by the King of Portugal what could be done to help the beleaguered city, Secretary of State Marquês de Pombal replied succinctly, "Sir, we must bury the dead and feed the living. If God was punishing Lisbon for its sins, it must have been a wicked, wicked city." Wow, there you go. That's another, you think we got it bad? Really, really bad things have happened many times in history. Natural things. Mother Nature got pissed. Boy, this is how you can get things wrong and maybe get things right. Americans named Hillary Clinton and President Barack Obama as their most admired woman and man of the year in 2015. Somehow I think that's a fixed poll. However, with Donald Trump earning the same share of admiration as Pope Francis, according to the results of the latest Gallup survey released Monday. So there you go. Go for it, Trump. Well, 54 years ago, the brand new Secretary of Defense, Robert Vietnam McNamara, thought he could bring Pentagon spending on everyday items under control by applying efficiencies he had used to help turn around the Ford Motor Company. Instead, he created a monster, McNamara's creation, known as the Defense Logistics Agency, has grown into a global $44 billion operation that, were it a private enterprise, would rank in a Fortune 50. Its 25,000 employees process roughly 100,000 orders a day for everything from poultry to pharmaceuticals, precious metals to aircraft parts. In terms of Pentagon contracts, it is nearly as large as Boeing and Lockheed Martin and the Pentagon's largest contractors combined. Led by military officials with little or no private sector experience, DLA lacks the redeeming features of the lean but efficient business McNamara envisioned. A trail of inspector generals reports show how DLA is systematically overcharged for parts. It buys things the military doesn't need, like 80 years worth of aircraft frames for a plane that will likely be out of use long before then. Wow. The General Accounting Office in 2010 estimated that about half of the agency's inventory, said to be worth nearly $14 billion at the time, is just taking up space. Quote, "How do you buy $7 billion of stuff you don't need?" unquote, exclaimed Arnold Pinheiro, a retired Major General in the Marine Corps Reserve who is currently overseeing a special task force on logistics for the Pentagon Defense Business Board. Quote, "If a company did what they do, they'd be out of business, even Walmart." Congress is now demanding that the entire Department of Defense undergo its first ever financial audit. And the DLA, which after 3 years of preparation says it's ready for a full scrub of its books, is a test case. A series of mock audits underway for 3 years demonstrate the enormous challenge. Well, you wonder why we go broke, why we go so far in debt as a country, why we'll never get out of debt. I hope you got the word I put out this morning. Someone passed to me, I'm not quite sure of it, that the head general, or whatever you want to call him, of ISIS is a Jew. I should have wrote down his name, but it's an Anglo name, the head of ISIS. Speaking of ISIS, Islamic State has set up departments to handle war spoils, including slaves and the exploitation of natural resources, such as oil, creating the trappings of a government that's enabled it to manage large swaths of Syria and Iraq and other areas. The hierarchical bureaucracy, including petty rivalries between officials and legal codes in the form of religious fatwas, are detailed in a cache of documents seized by U.S. Special Operations Forces in a May raid in Syria that killed top ISIS financial official Abdu Sayyaf. Reuters has reviewed some of the documents. The U.S. officials say the documents have helped deepen their understanding of a militant group whose skill in controlling the territory it has seized has surprised many. They provide insight into how a once small insurgent group has developed a complex bureaucracy to manage revenue streams from pillaged oil to stolen antiquities and oversee subjugated populations. This really kind of brings it out, the level of bureaucratization, organization, the Diwans, the committees. Brett McGurk, President Barack Obama's special envoy for the anti-ISIS coalition, told Reuters, for example, one Diwan, roughly equivalent to a government ministry, handles natural resources, including the exploitation of antiquities from ancient empires, another process of war spoils. I realize this is all based on religion, and that's what I've told you about religion, the Abrahamic religions especially. Reuters reported last week on a previously undisclosed ruling by the Islamic State's Research and Fatwa Committee that sanctions the harvesting of human organs. The fatwa raises concerns that the violent extremist group may be trafficking in body parts. Anything's okay as long as you blame it on your God. A booklet entitled From the Creator's Rulings on Captured Prisoners and Enslavement lays out rules on enslaving women seized from vanquished infidels. The October 2014 document reviews by Reuters attempts to ground the rules in Islamic law, citing sayings of the Prophet Muhammad. In the booklet calls for both kindness and cruelty to captives by Islamic State fighters. Enslaved women should not be separated from their children, it says. But elsewhere, the rules allow Islamic State fighters to have sex with female slaves. I think all armies have done that. Middle East Forum's Tom Almini said the fatwas are intended to bolster Islamic State's claim that it is a legitimate state. The rules not only apply to captured territory in Iraq and Syria, but also its self-declared provinces in Africa, the Sinai, and South Asia. They cover even mundane issues. In the documents, there is a ruling on proper procedure for filling out the personal details of prospective fighters, name, gender, and communication method, telephone, telegram, Skype, or the mobile messaging service, WhatsApp. So there you go. Yeah, all you have to do is dig up some old religion and you'll find all the excuses to kill you want. I know a lot of people in this country want to use the Old Testament. the Jew Old Testament as their excuse to kill people. I know when I was in Christian Identity, they wanted to use the Old Testament all the time. Well, as the non-white population grows, including this 20 to 30 million at least Mexicans from below the border, most states are becoming takers more than they're givers. They're taking more out of the trough than they're putting in. New York State is putting out more than it's taking in. West Virginia, Kentucky, Alabama. No, that's Mississippi. Let's see here. New Mexico, Arizona, California, and Oregon. And that Oregon just got on that list in the last 10 years because of the overflow from the non-whites leaving California and going up to Oregon. So James Baldwin scored each of the 50 states using his feed me ratio. State clients, number of public pensions, public employees, and welfare recipients versus private sector workers taxed to pay for it all. There you go. So let's see here. Let me go on down here and look at it. Forbes Interactive Map features the feed me ratio plus a fast fact on state and local spending in each of the 50 states from our online database at the openthebooks.com if you want to get more. Here's a rundown. Illinois scores 81.5%. By 2017, at least 10,000 retired educators will be getting $100,000 pensions. New York score 108.3%. 10 Port Authority cops got $309,000 or more in pay in 2014. A librarian in Queens got $391,594. And an elevator mechanic, supervisor for the city of New York, got $346,427. California score, 114.3. In other words, it's over the top. In Newport Beach, lifeguard compensation ranges from up from $211,912. Florida score 69.2. The city of Opaka manager got $510,296 in the final year of compensation and then started collecting two city pensions. A score over 100 means that there are more takers than makers. Across America, we investigated state and local spending and captured within our database at the openthebooks.com. Then we provided the fast fact for each of the 50 states. What did we miss? Search our state-by-state data at the openthebooks.com or use your mobile app, Open the Books. It's free in the App Store and the Google Play Store. Well, there you go. Pretty soon all the states are going to be spending more out in welfare and pensions and everything than they take in. So what do you think is going to happen then? What do you think is going to happen then? Let's see here. Well, number one, they're not going to be able to do it much longer. That's for sure. I would figure 50% of these people are not white. And probably 30% of them are from another country. I'm going to send along this open map that's interactive so you can check yourself on the figures from your own state. You know, in that San Bernardino shootout, it was only shooting from one side. Do we have another false flag? Do we have another maybe CIA or FBI setup? Sounds pretty interesting. Let me play it for you. Let me play it for you. Hold on.
When we, where I was at right here, we seen there was three white men in military fatigue taking off.
What were they driving?
It was a black Impala, SUV, or yeah.
You think that they might have been the shooters?
Yeah. The way they were driving, yeah. Yeah.
And how many shots did you hear?
Oh, a lot. It was a lot. It sounded like, yeah, like I said, it sounded like a gun range, just shots going off, like crazy. It was a lot. A lot of shots.
What's your first name?
Juan.
Juan, what's your last?
Hernandez.
All right. Thank you so much, sir.
One of the witnesses today is Sally Abdelmajid, who works at the Inland Regional Center, the building where the attack took place. She saw the attackers enter the building, and we spoke to her by phone.
I heard shots fired, and it was, you know, from an automatic weapon. So, you know, very unusual. Why would we hear shots? As we look out the window, a second set of shots goes off, and it's just pop, 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 pop. And we saw a man fall to the floor. Then we just looked, and we saw three men dressed in all black military attire with vests on. They're holding assault rifles, and they opened up the door to Building 3. And one of them opens up the door to Building 3. He starts to shoots all over into the room. That's the room that we typically have conferences in. And we just heard more gunshots go off. I got my phone. I reached for my phone. I called 911. And I just hid under my desk. I didn't see anymore. I just heard more gunshots go off as I was talking to the dispatch. We went into my manager's office, locked the door, barricaded it. We heard running and things happening upstairs. About 30 minutes later, someone came to the door, knocked on the door, but we didn't obviously answer. And then another 15 minutes later, someone came and took us into a secure room.
Ms. Abdelmajid, can you describe to me in as much detail as you can, what did the gunman look like?
I couldn't see his face. He had a black hat on, and from my view, all I could see was just a black hat and black long-sleeve shirt, possibly gloves on. He had black cargo pants on, the kind with the zippers on the sides and the big puffy pockets. He had a huge assault rifle, and he had extra ammo. He's coming ready for something to reload. I don't know. He had like magazines. I couldn't see what else. I just saw three dressed exactly the same.
You're certain that you saw three men?
Yes. It looks like their skin color was white. They looked like they were athletic build, and they appeared to be tall.
Well, what do you think? We got another black flag, false flag operation. They identified three instead of two. And now they have them in camo uniform or a police-type uniform. And so, and one identified them as three white men. Now, they could have been light-skinned Arabs or even Mexicans or whatever, but the fact that there were three and they only caught two is quite interesting. I think we're going to see a lot more of these false flag operations done by a renegade government. And it's going to be easy for these people to set up and false identify people around the country and even convict them of crimes and execute them, even when they didn't do it at all. You're going to see more of that. For those crazies that say, no, they wouldn't do that, well, they've already done that many times, not only in this country, but in other countries. You know, I'm asked all the time about Nietzsche. Was Nietzsche anti-Semitic or anti-Jewish? Was he pro-European or whatever? Well, this is a little piece I gathered off the internet let's see what they've got to say. Was Friedrich Nietzsche an anti-Semite? The late 19th century German philosopher made his fair share of disparaging remarks about Jews and Judaism in his published and unpublished writings. Far harsher, however, were his judgments about anti-Semites, Germans, and Christians. In a review of Nietzsche's Jewish Problem by Robert Holub, Brian Leiter, Leiter, that's one of the names in my family, my grandmother's side was Leiters from Germany. Anyhow, he defends the philosopher against the charge that anti-Semitism was integral to his thoughts. Got to remember, a lot of Jews are very hot for Nietzsche, too, and probably the Zionists borrowed much of their ideas from Nietzsche. Nietzsche's target is obviously not the Jewish or Christian religion or the adherents of either, but the values they embrace. The ascetic moralities that denounce lust for sex, wealth, cruelty, and power, moralities characteristic of all the world's major religion but unfamiliar in the ancient Greek and Roman world with which Nietzsche was deeply familiar. Nietzsche, in fact, uses Judaism and Christianity interchangeably throughout the genealogy of morality. Quote, everything is being made appreciably Jewish, Christian, or plebeian, never mind the words. He equates the slave revolt in morality, the overturning of the values of the Greek and Roman antiquities, with the values we now associate with Judeo-Christian morality, with the new treatment, with the Reformation and the triumph of the Catholic Pope in Rome. In his concluding chapter, Holub acknowledged that the real question is whether Nietzsche's alleged Judeophobic comments are concerned with issues of philosophical import and thus should affect how we understand his philosophy. To answer this question, though, we need to be clearer about what counts as objectionable Judeophobia. Surely it is wrongful to attack certain people based upon negative stereotypes related to the religion they practice. Well, I don't see why, but is it similarly objectionable to be critical of a morality associated with Judaism and Christianity and Islam? If so, then Nietzsche is not only a Judeophobe, but a Christophobe and an Islamophobe, and so on. Well, if he wasn't, he should have been, because all three of those religions have caused the world horrible troubles. Absolutely terrible troubles, and keep doing it all the time. Now, that's what I'm saying. His entire corpus is an attack on values endorsed by the world's major religions that he argues have pernicious psychological effects. Well, there you go. Well, I'll tell you the way I look at it, especially with the Jews. I think especially in relatively modern times, the Jews have been attacked for their money managing, money, more than religion. Religion may be used as an excuse, of course, where the Christians struggle with the Jews over Jesus and the execution of Jesus, which for a long, long time the Jews were blamed for it, but in fact there was no Jesus, so the Jews don't talk about that much because they know if they come out and start talking about it, the Christians will really go after them. So anyhow, I think from what I've read down through history, the fact that the Jews were, due to Christian activity, forced over into the money-making business or the banking business or the tax-collecting business, which puts them at loggerheads with the common people. And every once in a while, the peasants and common people would rise up and kill them. Well, it got to where they used their religion more of an excuse than the fact that they had become greedy and taking the money away from the poor people. And so I think that's the main reason why the Jews have been attacked, is because of their business practices down through the years. That's my opinion. And not so much a religion, because a religion, they created Christianity, and most of Christianity is Judaism. So it really is not so much religion as their practices with the money system. I think you can pick that up in the Mark Twain material I sent out to you just yesterday, I believe it was. So I think Mark Twain had it pretty well figured out about the problems with the Jews. Now it seems to me that the rank-and-file Christians have become just as rotten and corrupt and thieving as the Jews ever were. That it's going to be pretty hard to point the finger just at the Jews when we should be pointing the finger at the business end of Christianity too, for the same thing, and war-making and greed and so forth. The leadership of both sides use them to battle against the other group. So the Christians, either behind the scenes or out in the open, attack the Jews primarily for their money-making business, and the Jews attack the Christians as being Nazis. So I think it's six of one, half a dozen the other, something the right wing won't want to admit. If you didn't read that piece by Mark Twain that was in Harper's Magazine back at the end of the last century, or the end of the 19th century, you need to read it. Not that I agree with everything in there, but I think he pretty well bells the cat on a lot of this stuff. But the fact remains, to control massive amounts of people, you need religion. And the more mystical and more spooks in the sky it is, the better. In fact, the real story is Christianity and the Jews work very well together to screw everybody else.
One of the most powerful proofs for the fabrication of the character called Jesus Christ is to be found in plain sight in every copy of the New Testament. If ever there was an elephant in the room, this is it. And what is it that I'm talking about? Well, actually, I'm referring to the Gospel of John, otherwise known as the Fourth Gospel. It's commonly called the Fourth Gospel today because that naive belief that it was written by an illiterate Aramaic-speaking son of Zebedee called John the Apostle is patently absurd. Whatever else it may be, John's Gospel most certainly is not the memoirs of an old fisherman writing theology in polished Greek at his retirement home and using Mark as a crib sheet. John's Gospel is notoriously anti-Jewish, referring constantly to the Jews in opposition to the good guys, the followers of Jesus, supposedly Jews themselves. The authors of this Gospel construct whole speeches, thousands of words long, put into the mouth of a Jesus who in the other Gospels only ever speaks in pithy soundbites or pre-packed parables. Nor does John's Jesus have much concern for the poor and needy, but endlessly espouses his own divinity, glory and importance. What we have in John's Gospel is Jesus the God, a divinity just visiting planet Earth and making known that only he is to be worshipped and adored. It is a formulation put together by unknown apostate Jews and Judaized pagans in the 2nd century, at a time when there was no longer the expectation of an imminent judgment day. Theirs is a God for the long haul, designed to compete with and supplant the competition, whether it came from rabbinic Judaism, baptizers, Gnostics, or the priests of Dionysus or Asclepius. In their Gospel of John, the authors take shots at all of these. Christians I've always known that there were difficulties with the so-called Gospel of John, that it told a story often at odds with the three other Gospels, that it omitted many key episodes found in the Synoptic Gospels, including all those that named the Apostle John himself. But on the other hand, it introduced tales, miracles and characters quite unknown to the other evangelists, and which, if true, should have been mentioned by them. But over the centuries, Christians have found ways to sidestep the problems. That's why today they find it more convenient to jettison the purported author of the Gospel rather than the Gospel itself. Because, for better or worse, it's John's Gospel that defines many fundamental Christian beliefs, like the divinity of Christ, the immortality of the soul, or salvation by faith. Typically, Christian writers describe the fourth Gospel not as another biography of Jesus, but as a reflection on the meaning of Jesus. And yet, for all of its grand and florid interpretations of the substance and meaning of Jesus, all those endless metaphors about bread from heaven, the living water, the true vine, the shepherd and his sheep, etc., John's Gospel, nonetheless, does present another retelling of the story of Jesus. And it's here that we'll begin, because that rewritten core story explains the overblown theological superstructure that swamps this Gospel. The first striking revision in the fourth Gospel is that the ministry of Jesus has ballooned out from 1 year to three. The writers make reference not just to one, but to three distinct Passover festivals. Now, is this just a different tradition that some early Christians held to, a tradition of a three-year ministry and others to a one-year ministry? Can anyone honestly maintain that whole dialogues could be remembered word for many decades, and yet believers have no common agreement whether these words were said during 1 year or during 3 years? Let me give you an alternative explanation. The writers of John's Gospel so drastically reorganized and rewrote the material inherited from Mark, Matthew and Luke that they created the need for three Passovers in order to fit in their new theology, restatements and dogmas. In Mark's original story, the drama builds to an eventual confrontation in Jerusalem where Jesus drives out the money changers and cleanses the temple. From that moment on, the Jewish authorities plot to kill Jesus. Now, John's Gospel, dating from a much later time when the Christians are separated from the Jews, wants to emphasize this point of detachment and supersession. That faith in Christ is a complete break from the old and obsolete Judaism. So the cleansing of the temple is shifted to the start, not the end of Jesus' ministry. This is Passover number one. Now, having shifted the cleansing of the temple to the beginning of Jesus' ministry, John's chronology has lost the original climax of the story, so it needed a new trigger for the final events. This the authors provide by inventing a miracle that surpasses all earlier miracles, the raising of Lazarus after 4 days in the grave. This new miracle is merely a reworking of a parable found in Luke, but it does the trick. So in John's revised script, it's the raising of Lazarus that now impels the Jewish authorities to plot to kill Jesus. These events are added to the chronology at Passover number two. But we're not finished. In the original tale, Jesus shares a Passover meal with his disciples and institutes a meal of remembrance of himself. But when the authors of John are writing, Christianity has already severed its Jewish roots and has adopted practices drawn from the pagan mystery religions. So John's Jesus doesn't share a Passover meal with his disciples. Instead, he becomes the Passover meal. It's for this reason, and not some curious slip in the collective memory, that in John's Gospel, the Last Supper and the crucifixion itself occur a day earlier than in the other Gospels. Jesus is prepared for his sacrifice on the very same day that Passover lambs are prepared. Now, making Jesus into the sacrificial lamb of God is no minor point. At this stage, the church is defining its dogmas and regularizing its sacraments. A halt has been called to further speculations and personal revelations. A deal-breaker becomes the willingness of would-be Christians to take part in the newly instituted Eucharist by eating Jesus' flesh and drinking his blood. So now we have the reason why John's Gospel adds a third Passover festival between festivals 1 and 2. It is to allow Jesus himself to spell out the new Eucharist. The writers of John have Jesus leave Jerusalem and return to Galilee just before another Passover festival, where they insert the story of loaves and fishes from Mark's Gospel. And having regurgitated an embellished version of Feeding the 5,000, John's Gospel now presents a great discourse on the bread of life, repurposing the food miracle as an introduction to something altogether different. At some length, Jesus explains to his followers the hard saying that they must eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood to have life. The text even records that many of the Jews stopped being Jesus' disciples at this point. We thus see that John's Gospel isn't the memory of a different tradition, with a number of curious anomalies but traceable nonetheless to an eyewitness of amazing events. On the contrary, the fourth Gospel is the handiwork of a church flexing its muscles and beginning to enjoy earthly rewards. Without embarrassment, the authors of John redact and revise the foundational story of Jesus. They reorder, they invent, they delete, and they lie to suit their own purposes. A whole gospel, a tissue of invention and fraud. But is John's gospel unique? No, of course not. All the gospels are a tissue of invention and fraud. But the lies get more cunning and self-serving with each re-editing.
So you see, it all started with the Jews and some Greeks and so forth like that, and they went through times of getting along together, and then they split up and they started fighting each other and killing each other and so forth, and on it's gone down through history. And just remember that the National Socialists under Hitler, of course, turned into not being National Socialism at all, but his desire was to move the Jews out of Germany, or people of the Jewish background. So he began to do that, and thousands of Jews went to Palestine long before the war. And Hitler conspired with the Zionists to complete this plan. Well, somewhere along the way, things got a little out of hand, but still, obviously, Hitler didn't kill near as many Jews as the Jews would like to say, because the beautiful thing about that is they could say, well, he couldn't have been trying to help the Jews and populate Israel if he's killing all the Jews. Well, you don't understand that some people can be very, very, very bad. And the Jews, if they thought for world power and gaining a homeland that they could do all their nefarious business from, would they sacrifice a few hundred thousand Jews? Of course they would, especially a lot of the assimilated German Jews that were really, in many cases, very patriotic to the fatherland. So if you want to punch a hole in their balloon, these people, you say Hitler is the founder of Israel. Who else could be given credit for it? Hitler working with the Zionists. And so here he's seen as the most evil man that ever lived, but yet Israel should think they're whatever they think, spooks in the sky, for Hitler, for creating Israel. It's still going to take a certain amount of years to get this all straightened out, but it will be straightened out. The facts are there if you dig them out. They're there. I mean, why did Hitler go over to Eastern Europe, or not he, but his representatives in the SS, and strike a deal with the Zionists early on, and even strike a coin to celebrate it? Now, people don't want to talk about that stuff, but they better talk about it, because they'll never figure this mess out if they don't. Let's talk a little bit about the comparison between guns that police use to kill people and tasers to kill people and mace or pepper spray. You notice hardly any cops, they hardly ever talk about a cop using pepper spray. And yet pepper spray, well, it is used, but they don't talk about it to the public because they don't really want the public knowing how effective pepper spray is. So anyhow, that's we're going to have a little thing on that here.
From Walter Scott to Eric Harris, fatal police shootings have dominated headlines over the past few weeks. But it's not just bullets that are leading to unnecessary death. It's tasers, too. See, despite their status as a non-lethal alternative weapon, Amnesty International reports that over 500 people died from tasers between 2000 and 2012. And it's this reality that is the subject of the new documentary film, Tom Swift and His Electric Rifle, that just premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival. Earlier, we were joined by the director of the film, Nick Berardini, and we started by asking him why he was inspired to make this film.
You know, for me, it really started when I was a student reporter at the University of Missouri. I was finishing my journalism degree and just coincidentally happened to be working a reporting shift when a 23-year-old Stanley Harlan was pulled over at a traffic stop, tasered for 31 seconds in the chest, and died on the scene in front of his parents, unfortunately. And so I just happened to be the first reporter on the scene that night. And then it seemed kind of like a pretty surface, with my surface understanding of the weapon, it seemed like a pretty obvious case of misuse. But as I began to kind of make this film after graduation, I was making it, you know, about the fractured relationship between the community and the police after this incident. And then I just really became fascinated with what happened to him, why it happened to him, ultimately leading me to Taser International, the only manufacturer of the weapons.
I think that was what was so interesting, is your ability to get so much access and candor from Rick and Tom Smith, who run and created, as you said, Taser International. How in the world did you get that much access from them?
Well, you know, I think it just goes back to wanting to be honest. I mean, I went in really unassuming. I was 24 when I interviewed Steve Tuttle, the Vice President of Communications. I just wanted to, and I promised to, keep an open mind about their perspective, because as I started researching Taser International more, I understood, you know, the aggressive marketing and a company doing what it does. In fact, the analogy I used, you know, is that a pharmaceutical company wouldn't tell you the side effects of a drug unless it had to. With Taser International, though, the difference was it wasn't just that they weren't telling you the side effects of the drug, in this case, the side effects of the weapon. It was that they were actively telling their customer, police officers, that those side effects did not exist.
I want to play a quick clip from your film about what officers, with two officers speaking about what it's like and why, what they have to go through on the street.
You can't let this guy hurt you, and you can't let him walk down the street, you know, and possibly hurt somebody else, you know. So you have to make a split decision. And like Nat said, you have to always get it right. We're not given a whole lot of leeway for being wrong out here.
I always found that interesting, where you can argue a case in court and the judge can come back in 90 days with an opinion. Whereas, you know, we go to a situation and you have to decide right now if you're going to make an arrest, or if you know, someone decides to resist, what level of force you're going to use. And if it's improper, then you have to deal with the consequences.
So, Nick, do you feel that, in listening to those officers, it feels like there's a culture at play there of that, this idea that, well, you know, it's either we're going to have to use guns or we're going to get killed. It's sort of kill or be killed, and we don't have time to think about this, but we're required to. Do you think that culture comes from the marketing behind what Taser has done over the years in pushing their product?
The police are the ones who are going to deal with these consequences. When something goes bad, the company has been very effective. Now, they have been hit with some liability in the past 5 years, and we meet some of the attorneys that have been successful suing them. They become really fascinating characters in their own right. But ultimately, you know, it's the police officers who have to make these decisions, and they do evolve rapidly. The problem is we took a very complicated problem of police brutality, and we took this weapon and thought that it would solve all. You know, and now the company would say it's not a magic bullet, but that's not really what the impression was when it was first sold. To the public, it was sold as an alternative to deadly force. It's not used as an alternative to deadly force. It's mainly used as a compliance tool. And to police officers, the reason it was used as a compliance tool is because of the way it was marketed as sort of this 100% effective and safe way to subdue a person in a potentially violent situation. And that idea of preemptive force became really dangerous because the more confidence they had in the weapons, the more they felt they could use them at lower and lower levels of force. And ultimately, people died in situations where their lives should have never been in jeopardy.
Taser International is the only manufacturer of conducted energy weapons which are used by over 15,000 law enforcement agencies in the United States alone. In turn, they have been the only one putting out data on their own product, which was noted by an officer in your film. Are there other resources for law enforcement to get better data aside from, obviously, your film and Taser International?
There's no real mandatory reporting for any use of force. That includes shootings. So we're really going in blind with what these numbers are. You're kind of just, that's what allows Taser to sort of say things that seem like they might be true, which they aren't true necessarily, like the amount of lives saved. It's very subjective and obviously, you know, is called into question in the film. But, you know, for me, really, what it comes down to is that the company did an incredible job convincing police departments that they were on the same side. And Of course, that goes contrary to the point of a company. Now, a company can have multiple missions, but none of those matter unless it survives. And ultimately, what you see in this film is you see these brothers start out as idealistic entrepreneurs and then routinely choose survival as they progress. And that's why it's effective to take their perspective, because we're more interested in why this happened as opposed to what happened, you know, and getting to the root of these decisions, because officers need to be aware that the message that they're getting, you know, isn't necessarily in their best interests. And in a lot of cases, they're the ones holding the bag when something goes wrong.
Well, it's my belief that there's two things that really add to this, and this is so many guys are coming back from all the wars that we're playing around with around the world, where they're used to having to think even faster and employ violence to solve a problem. But they're coming back here and they're getting on the police forces all over the place, and they get on real easy. And I think that's one of the big problems we have here, plus the fact there's others that get on the force who may put on a big, brave front and a big, brave police uniform, but they're cowards. I've seen a lot of these street situations that ended up in death that the cop could have just stood back a little bit and used his brain and used some other method. They even have these, of course, these rubber bullets and things like that that he wouldn't have had to kill. And I've seen that happen over and over again to where these guys are jumping the gun. I think it's primarily either because they're too macho or they're too cowardly. And that's my opinion. And obviously anything like this, a shock like that given to the body can cause heart troubles and all kinds of stuff. Depends on your physical shape, and the average American, no matter what color he is out of shape. Now, we had another one last night in Chicago where the cops got the wrong apartment. There was a 9/11 call. They come on the scene and they shot an old lady. I think she was in her 80s. I think she might even have been in a wheelchair, and then proceeded to shoot her son that supposedly had nothing to do with anything, that they were in the wrong apartment. Jesus Christ. Well, Germany's got a couple of new films out. Of course, you know what that's all about. With two new films, German cinema has rediscovered the country's fiercest Nazi hunter, former prosecutor Fritz Bauer, honoring a man who fought against the post-war amnesia about the Holocaust. A Jew and social democrat who spent time in a Nazi concentration camp, a German concentration camp. It wasn't a Nazi concentration camp. It was a German concentration camp. Before going into wartime exile, Bauer became the most hated lawyer in Germany after World War II. One of his biographers, Ronan Stenke, told AFP, honoring him on the big screen with the stories of his two biggest battles places him finally back where he belongs in the collective consciousness, said Munich Daily, Süddeutsche Zeitung. Labyrinth of Lies is the name of the one film by Giulio Riccioli. Germany's short list of submissions for the best foreign film feature at February's Oscars. Of course, he'll get one. Anytime you talk about the so-called Holocaust in a certain way, you're going to win. Describes one of the Bauer's chief accomplishments, bringing to justice 22 former Auschwitz officials in the 60s. The story focuses on a fictional young idealistic public prosecutor who works under Bauer and fights against a conspiracy of silence and resistance in a judicial establishment filled with ex-Nazis. Quote, "Do you want every German to ask if their father was a murderer?" Unquote. The young prosecutor is asked angrily in the movie. "Yes, that's exactly what I want," he replies firmly. "I want these lies and this silence to end." Well, let's see here. Before the 1963-65 trial in Frankfurt, a significant proportion of Germans believed the pictures of the concentration camps were Allied propaganda. Well, part of them were, that's for sure, wrote prosecutor Eduardo Cristoforo Rautenberg in Newsweekly Die Zeit. Bauer wanted to break the silence of these Nazi crimes at a time when West German society, during its economic miracle years, preferred to turn the page on the horrors of the Holocaust, said Steinke. The target of hate mail, anti-Jew phone calls, and a bomb threat, I've had that stuff. Bauer, then the chief prosecutor of Central Hesse State at Frankfurt, was also the subject of a neo-Nazi plot to assassinate him, said his biographer. Well, join the club. In the Frankfurt courtroom, dogs had to search for explosive every morning. Well, they did that in Portland when I had my civil trial. A second movie, The People vs. Fritz Bauer by Lars Kromi, released at the Switzerland's Locarno International Film Festival, tells the story of how Bauer helped track down fugitive top Nazi Adolf Eichmann, who we're pretty sure now was a Jew, known as the architect of the Holocaust in Argentina. You know, the film portrays Bauer aged in his 50s, a stocky figure with a white name, a white mane, gruff manner and piercing eyes behind thick glasses also evoked his rumored homosexuality at a time when sex between men was still punished with prison. Well, that's cute. "As soon as I come out of my office, I enter enemy territory," Bauer once said as he faced massive obstruction by lawyers who had served during the Third Reich, according to the historian Werner Rentz. In 1957, in a deliberate act of high treason that could have landed him in jail, Bauer passed on to Israel's Mossad Secret Service information that led to the spectacular kidnapping of Eichmann. Eichmann was abducted by Israeli agents in Buenos Aires in 1960, convicted in 1961 and hanged in Israel in a year later. I think more to keep his mouth shut than anything else. For Bauer, it was only a partial victory. Eichmann did not face justice in Germany. Berlin had never requested the extradition of the top Nazi. That's because he knew so much. Whose testimony could have implicated former Nazi collaborators in high places. The influence, especially in the industrial classes and the wealthy ruling classes, the influence of Bauer, who was in 1933 interned in a concentration camp and then went into exile in Denmark and Sweden during the war, has continued to grow after his death inside the courts and beyond. His notion that the Nazi extermination camps were collective enterprises of death, where every cog in the machine shared part of the guilt, did not triumph at the Frankfurt trial. Well, anyhow, it's a big, long article, but there's these two movies that'll get everybody all excited about the poor Jews again. Do you notice there's never been a film made about this agreement between the SS and the Zionists? That I know of. If you know of one, tell me about it. They need to keep exploring because they've only gone part way, the part way that makes Germany all guilty. And they need to go all the way to see this conspiracy between the Jews and the National Socialists in Germany. And actually to populate Palestine and dispossess the Palestinian people and replace them with Jews, European Jews. And that's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow on Tuesday. Okay, remember 14:05 and keep digging historically. And, you know, sometimes I talk out of both sides of my mouth because there's some things that really need to be researched. The problem is they research very deeply all the wrong things in history, the things that don't matter as much.